Hello and welcome back, Podheads. I am your host, Kate Carter.
I'm Kylie Colwell.
And I'm Holly Spear.
And welcome back to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. So I'm going to be your host today, and I'm going to be telling you guys a story out of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. You may know this one, you may not. I didn't know it until I started doing research on it, but let me give you a little bit of an intro. It was the beginning of 2002 when Krista Worthington, a well-known fashion writer and editor, was found brutally murdered in her home. For years, the question of who was responsible for her death haunted the small town, and it's still being talked and questioned about today. In this episode, I'm going to be talking through the details of Krista's life, the untimely events that led to her death, and the investigation that turned the town of Cape Cod upside down, the twists and turns, and the aftermath. So let's get started. So Krista Worthington was born on December 23rd, 1956, and she was born in like the suburb of Boston, Massachusetts, in a town called Hingham. She grew up in a pretty wealthy family. Her dad was like a really prominent local attorney, very successful. And she herself was very into academics, always did really good in school, kind of focused more on academics than like sports growing up. So after graduating high school, Krista was accepted into and attended a college called Vassar College, V-A-S-S-A-R. I actually had never heard of this school, but apparently it's located in New York. It's a very like selective private school and is super hard to get into. Like, I think their acceptance rate is like 12%. It's a liberal fine arts school. And there's some famous alumni that have gone there, like Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway, Jane Fonda, Justin Long. I mean, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good list. Krista did really good in college. She graduated top of her class. She studied literature. And after college, she moved to New York City. And she put a career into the fashion industry, but she was a fashion writer. So she ended up working decades in like the high fashion industry. She worked for a few companies like Cosmopolitan, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, New York Times, stuff like that. So like she was like a big name. So Krista personally, because she was so busy with work, she was like known to date around. She never really settled down or wanted to commit in a relationship. She saw herself being too busy. She traveled too often. People said with this, Krista was also pretty much a free spirit. Like she was very independent and known to be a power woman, which we love. She was well educated, worked a demanding job, and lived in New York City. So like you kind of have to be, I guess. As Krista got older, and particularly when she hit like when she was about to hit her 40s, she realized that she had been so focused on her career that now she was kind of regretting settling down earlier to have a family, something she always wanted. She always wanted to be a mom, but she wanted to do so after getting married. So there was multiple articles, and I think she even went on a talk show at some point. Krista always talked about, yeah, sure, she wanted to have a kid after marriage, but she was 100% okay being a solo mom. Like having a kid on her own, not having to have a partner to raise the kid with. But if you can only imagine in the 1990s, like going to a sperm bank and getting pregnant wasn't really the route that people went. Like it wasn't really popular.
I feel like that's still not that popular. Maybe I'm wrong, but
I feel like
it's crazy.
Like people don't talk about it.
Yeah, it's taboo. And that would also be really hard, I think, too.
Krista made a plan that she was going to start dating a bunch of different guys. And she was going to meet these guys all over the place. And basically what she was going to try to do is she was going to try to get pregnant from one of them, but not tell the guy. We don't condone this.
Dang. Yeah.
This is a no-no. Yeah. I don't even know what to say about that, but that was her plan. You know, she was like, I'm not going to be in a relationship. I'm just going to do this on my own. So I'm just going to like, you know, kind of sleep around, have fun and not tell the guy if I end up getting pregnant. While Krista began doing this, she kind of noticed right off the bat that nothing was happening. She wasn't getting pregnant. She wasn't showing any signs of potentially getting pregnant. And at some point, she decided to go get medical advice. And that's when she was diagnosed with early menopause. So early menopause, usually in menopause in general, it's considered to make it extremely difficult for women to have a baby on their own. Her chances of having a kid with early menopause is 5%. So like, that's sad, you know? if you've always wanted to be a mom, and that's the news that you get. So as it would for any woman who's wanting to be a mom, this information took a toll on her. Not knowing that she would most likely ever be able to produce a child of her own, she became kind of depressed, started to isolate herself. And shortly after she got the diagnosis, she decided to like quit her job. She was going to leave New York City. She wanted to chill out and put everything behind her. So she decided to move to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. In her mind, moving out of the city would help escape like the busy work life as well. Like she kind of attributed, maybe I haven't been pregnant. Sure, I'm a little bit older. Like she hadn't even hit 40 yet, you know? So she's not that old. People are having babies in their 50s now, but she was thinking like maybe the rush of the job and stress and everything just led to all of those events, which is totally, totally possible. Mm-hmm. She chose to go to Cape Cod because she had actually been raised going there during the summer with her family. She always loved it. So that she was already connected to the place. Like she already knew this is where I quote unquote want to like retire kind of thing. So in 1997, Krista headed off to her new home in the area of Truro, T-R-U-R-O, Truro is what I'm going to say. So it's like a neighborhood in Cape Cod. She moved into this house that apparently her grandmother used to own, which is cool. Well, speaking of, Krista's family, they were well off and they were very well known in Cape Cod because for the past 40 to 50 years, her family had owned multiple houses out there and still did. And since Cape Cod was such a small town, like everybody knows everybody. You know, so people knew who she was when she moved there. So this little house was really cute. It was right on the water. Krista was able to get away from her once busy life. She relaxed for once. And pretty early on after she moved there, she met a man named Tony Jacket. Yes, like a jacket. Tony was well known in Cape Cod also because he was the shellfish constable.
Oh, yeah. Please explain.
Yes. What the hell is that? That's exactly what I was thinking. I had no idea. I had to look it up. Basically, a shellfish, which is a hard word, shellfish constable, make sure that all of the fishermen, like the local fishermen, are abiding by fishing and ocean laws. Isn't that just wildlife police? You know, like, I don't, whatever. So
specifically shellfish, Kate.
Yes.
That's shellfish. Adorable.
Catching illegal fish, he's going to get you. Bringing in too much, booked straight to jail. So Tony was the man for that. He was like the police of fish. So this Tony dude, Tony Jacket, he's married and he has 6 kids. He pretty much always lived in the Cape Cod area. And at some point he ended up at Krista's house fixing something for her. Like he works in the fish industry, honey. He's not, you know, fixing your dishwasher kind of thing, but he ended up at her house to do something. One thing led to another. They ended up hooking up and wouldn't you know it, Krista got pregnant.
Finally.
Good for her. Not a good moment. Mr. Married Man with 6 kids.
Yeah.
Her little love affair with naughty boy Tony got her pregnant. And obviously this was a huge shock because she was told she basically can't get pregnant. 5% chance is really, really low. As you can imagine, Tony was not too thrilled with the news, you know, married. His wife had no idea. He's
the shellfish constable.
Right. He's going to get in trouble. You know, he doesn't need another kid. He's got 6. But if you remember, Krista was totally okay with being a single mom. So in fact, she was totally okay with not having Tony around to be the baby's daddy. So Krista and Tony made this pact that they were never going to tell his wife. And they were not going to tell the kid who her dad was kind of thing. Like they were just going to keep it all a secret. Although Krista let Tony off the hook for this one, she ended up like regretting her situation, which I understand because as her pregnancy went along, like as she got further and further into her pregnancy, she became more and more sick. She didn't really have any help at all. And she was going through this pregnancy by herself. Like her family wasn't up there. They were living back in Boston or whatever. She was pissed. She was like, look, you knocked me up. You left me to do my own thing. You're not helping out at all. I will say she got very sick during her pregnancy because it's a wives' tale, but it's also an extremely true wives' tale that the more sick you are during your pregnancy, the more likely it's going to be a girl. And in May of 1999, Krista gave birth to a little baby girl named Ava. And as soon as Ava was born, Krista obviously was like head over heels for her. This is all she ever wanted. So Krista's family and friends would later say, like, she was the best mom ever. She was so patient with Ava, caring, loved going on adventures. Basically, anywhere Krista went, she took Ava with her. And for the first year and a half of Ava's life, Tony was not around. Like, Tony's family never found out about her or anything for like a year and a half. Until Krista decided to write a letter to Tony's wife. It should be mini novel because it was 5 pages.
Why did she do that?
And it explained everything. So Tony's wife is named Susan. Krista wrote Susan that her and Tony had been having a relationship for years. They had a kid together named Ava. Susan received this letter. I guess it was mailed, maybe dropped off. Who knows? This blows my mind. Susan got the letter. She reads it. She finds out about this love affair, this love child. She was like, I'm cool with the situation.
These people are all weird.
What? You're totally okay with it.
I would not be.
No, I think she did it more so for the benefit of Ava, but she was totally okay with having Ava and their family and like a part of their lives from here on out. In fact, Susan ended up inviting Krista and Ava over for dinner every Sunday night. So like, she was like, welcome to the fam. I mean, you know what? It just makes me think she's a great woman, but maybe she was a little crazy because that's just not a thing I would do. But Susan put in a lot of effort to be a part of Ava's life. She was like, this is the situation. I'm going to take it. We love you. Go off, Susan. But I don't know how the hell she decided to stay with Tony. I would have been out of there.
I mean, that maybe that's good for the kid is what her mindset is. But I feel like at the same time, maybe not.
When she's older, she's going to be like, what the hell is happening
very
here?
Confused.
Yes. Okay. So moving on. Around October 2001, Ava is about 2 years old at this point. And Krista is about 45 years old. The fall and winter came. You know, the two began to see less and less people. Obviously, Krista was pretty social, but this wasn't like her choice. It's, you know, Cape Cod is a really touristy town. It's super small. But people were there during the summer. You know, during the fall and winter, it gets hella cold. And so the only people that are there are the locals. On January 4th, 2002, at a local grocery store, Krista and Ava can be seen from the surveillance footage shopping together. 2 days later, on January 6, 2002, Krista's body is found. Former boyfriend of Krista's, his name is Tim. Tim was heading to Krista's house by the ocean to return a flashlight to her that he had borrowed. As Tim approached the front door, he noticed that there were two newspapers laying by the door. And obviously that kind of signaled to him that Krista hadn't been outside in a few days. Otherwise, she would have picked up the newspapers. When no one answered the door, Tim decided he was going to look through the windows at the front of the house, but he wasn't able to really see anything. So he decided he was going to go inside. He turned the doorknob and the front door was unlocked and it just kind of pushed open. And as soon as the door opened, Tim immediately saw Krista's body laying on the ground in front of him and she was covered in blood. Tim ran over to Krista, looked for a heartbeat, but her body was basically cold to the touch. Krista was only wearing a shirt, no pants or underwear. She was laying face up and had been brutally stabbed multiple times. To make things a lot worse, the baby's not dead. I mean, that would have been the worst case scenario, but this is really sad. Baby Ava, who was 2 years old, was just sitting there next to her mom's body. Ava was alive and unharmed. And next to Ava on the ground in her hands, Tim found wet cotton swabs. Ava had found the cotton swabs in the house, got them wet from the kitchen sink, and was trying to use them to clean up her mom.
Aww.
Is that not so sad? Like, she's just sitting there for 2 days on her own. On top of that, while Tim was there, like while this was all happening, Ava also tried to nurse from her mom. This is so sad.
Yes. Yeah.
Her mom's dead body is just laying on the ground. She obviously has no idea. And she's like, mommy's covered in blood. I'm going to go get things to help like wash her off, clean her up. All of it's just pretty horrific. Obviously, Tim immediately called the police. He picked up Ava and went back to his car in Krista's driveway. I forgot to mention something. So Tim was currently living at his parents' house in Cape Cod. And I guess when Tim went out to run errands, return the flashlight, whatever, his dad decided to come with him. So Tim's dad is out in the car in the driveway, just sitting there waiting for Tim to return. And obviously when Tim comes out, his dad can see he has blood on him. He's carrying Krista's daughter, who was also covered in blood, and both of them just looked like completely disheveled. And when Tim told his dad about Krista and that she had been killed, his dad's first response was, "Did you do it?" Weird. Red flags. Also, Tim, I don't know why you told people that later on. Obviously, it goes without saying, but Tim was the first suspect on the list when the police found out. I mean, he was the first person to find her body. His fingerprints were all over her. He used to date her. Why was he returning a flashlight at the house? Like, it's just very random. Not to mention, we find out from the police later on that when they started to investigate Tim, they found out that he was like mildly obsessed with her, like stalking level. So maybe not mildly, like he was obsessed. Apparently, the two of them broke up from their very short relationship, and Krista would often find Tim on her property looking through her windows.
Okay, so he's weird, weird.
So he's obsessed. Like that would, that's a restraining order for me.
100%.
So maybe the dad's comment wasn't that weird.
Yeah, maybe he knew his son was a little odd. The police arrived at Krista's house. Tim was still there with his dad. There was Ava. And then Tony and his wife, Susan, pulled up as well. So, okay, get this. Apparently, a police officer would later say on record that Susan, when she got to the house and like found out the situation, she said, quote, "Don't listen to anything that little girl says. She's a fucking liar," end quote.
The two-year-old?
Susan said that about the two-year-old.
Okay. Okay.
To a cop, apparently. Now, according to Susan, she ain't never said that. You know, she's like, "I love Ava. I've never in my life said that." So we don't know if that really happened, but just like keep that in the back of your head that if that did happen, that's very weird. Why would you say that? First of all, a two-year-old's like barely speaking.
It's in the back of my head. Don't worry. That's Thanks. Crazy.
Obviously, the comment made like the police a little suspicious of Susan and her husband.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Tony's the baby daddy anyway, so he should be on the list. But before we talk about suspects and how that all plays out, let's talk about the crime scene. Krista's car was in her driveway at the house, but her keys were found on the ground next to it. There was also these weird lines in the gravel leading from her car to her front door, and police said that it looked like something had been dragged. When the police got to the front door, they stated multiple times it had looked like somebody had kicked it from the outside, which is something Tim never said. You remember he was like, "I turned the handle, the door was open, it just opened on its own." You would kind of know if a door has been kicked in.
Yeah.
Like, and he never said that to the cops. So just throwing that
out. Well, and it wouldn't have been locked in any way. You would have known that it just like swung open or.
Right. Yeah. So he just never said anything about it. But once an autopsy was done on Krista, it was found that she had a lot of defensive wounds on her hand and arms, which is really sad. And obviously that means she was trying to fight back whoever was attacking her. Krista had been stabbed multiple times by a kitchen knife, but said kitchen knife was never found. But that also being said, you remember like this all happening in a small town, it's small town police. They did a really crappy job at securing the crime scene, which shocker, shocker. All the evidence was touched. They did try their best, but they just weren't used to this kind of situation. Like murders didn't happen in Cape Cod. An example of this was one of the police officers at some point early on, he grabbed a blanket from inside Krista's living room and he laid it on top of her body. We can only imagine he did this to like give Krista, you know, respect since she was basically naked. But like, that's just putting potential evidence on Krista. That's also messing with evidence, you know, like fingerprints, shit like that. You have no idea. So also the police didn't stop other people from walking around on the property. Like they never taped off the house or anything or restricted it. So like people like Tim, Tony, Susan, others, they were just walking in and out of the house with Krista's dead body right there. So like nothing was taped off, which we know royally F's with crime scenes.
Yeah. I mean, I get if they don't have murders there often, you might lack the knowledge of some things, but taping off the crime scene and not letting people walk around, that seems really basic. But
that's what I was thinking too. When we talk about like police officers, cops, investigators, whatever, and we give them an excuse of like, "Oh, it doesn't happen often. Like they might not know to do this." Don't they all go through the same trainings?
Have they not watched a single episode of Forensic Files?
Makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like even it's common knowledge. I don't know. So, well, okay. Other than that, and other than Krista's body, The house was found in absolute disaster. Like, it was a shit show. There was stuff just thrown everywhere. It looked like somebody had ransacked the house. But later on, we would find out from her friends that Krista was actually pretty messy. And so this might have been like the norm for her to just have shit everywhere. But the people who did go inside her house during the lack of crime scene setup said that it was much worse. It was like a much worse condition than normal. So we don't really know at this point, like, was it normal? Was it not? In the house on top of the kitchen counter was Krista's cell phone. And get this, Krista's phone was open. It had the number 9 dialed on the screen, which obviously makes it look like she had attempted to dial 911, but wasn't able to complete the phone call. Like I said earlier, when Krista's body was found, Ava was lying next to her. Obviously, the little cotton swabs were found, which I told you guys about, and Ava had been trying to clean up her mom's bloody body with. But another sad thing is Ava also had one of her sippy cups on the ground that was filled with water from the kitchen, and she had a few washcloths. So if you kind of put two and two together, like, Ava basically went around the house to get things to help her mom. Like, she was trying to feed her water. She was trying to clean her up. And like, her mom's just not responding, obviously, which that just breaks. I can't even imagine. That just breaks my heart.
Yeah.
So when police tried to talk to Ava, she's a baby. They were trying to like figure out when the murder took place, you know, what happened. But obviously you have to ask a child in a different way. So they were asking things like, when's the last time you ate? Or when's the last time you had a diaper change? Stuff like that. But apparently Ava was just like dead silent, sat there refusing to move from her mom's side. Like, she didn't want to talk to anybody. She was just sitting there next to her mom. As for the investigation, obviously the police first person they looked at was Tim. Makes sense. He found her body. He was an ex. He was kind of obsessive. I mean, we know at this point that Krista and Tim dated at some point and that he was obsessed with her, but police also found out that they were still kind of together. Like, they would hook up occasionally and just not tell people. Tim basically had been around for most of Ava's life, so he was kind of a father figure to Ava, which is nice. When police found Krista's home phone answering machine, they found a large number of voicemails that had been left by Tim. I'm not gonna lie, they were kind of odd. It seemed like a lot of the voicemails at first were Tim asking Krista to like go out and do stuff, like dates. And then later it turned into him realizing that she wasn't gonna call him back. And then it turned into him being like, can I still see Ava? But I don't think you and I should meet. So like, we don't really know what the timeline of their relationship was or like how it was when Krista died, because you couldn't really believe what Tim was saying because he was just all over the place. As police dove more into him, he had a lot of people back him up saying like, this wasn't something he'd do. There's no way. And eventually the police came to the conclusion that they didn't have any evidence or proof that it was Tim. So he got ruled out as a suspect.
I was thinking it was going to be Tim.
Yeah. Well, the next suspect, or shall I say suspects, was obviously Tony and his wife, Susan. Apparently, whatever she said to the police officer about Ava, like, how could you not question them as suspects? And they showed up to the house like before the police did. I assume Tim called. But during the police investigation, officers found a diary notebook in Krista's bedroom. And towards the end of the diary, they found lots and lots of angry entries about Susan. It was mostly about like how upset Krista was about the whole Tony situation, like him impregnating her and him not helping. But then it said a lot of things about how awful Susan was, which is different from what we had heard or thought. So the police, when they found this, they began to think like, did Susan just snap on Krista at some point? You know, did the cheating, the child out of marriage, you know, could be any of that could be a factor if Susan like killed Krista. Obviously, like, Susan hadn't seen any of the diary entries. And then on top of that, according to Susan and Tony and other people, Susan had been for the past year trying to build a relationship with Krista ever since she found out about Ava. Susan really loved Ava. She always accepted her as part of their family. It just really didn't make any sense like that Susan would kill Krista. I mean, wouldn't you think in this situation she would have killed her husband before killing the mistress? I don't know, but I would have killed my husband. During their investigation, the police gave both Susan and Tony polygraph tests, and they passed. But that didn't stop the police from, like, still digging into more of, like, could they be killers? But side note, ladies, what do we say about polygraphs?
Don't take them.
Hell no. They don't prove shit. They can't be used in court. I mean, there's no need. They passed. Congratulations. But still, it doesn't mean anything. So the police were able to dig up some info about Tony. And it turns out that recently, Tony had been under pressure from Krista about providing more financial aid for Ava. For example, Krista had asked Tony to put Ava on his health insurance. Obvious reasons, Tony was working, Krista was not. So why, you know, it's his kid. Why wouldn't he do it? Krista had even hired legal counsel to potentially sue Tony if he wasn't willing to help out more with child support. And then get this. So Tony's Ava's dad, right? Well, in the year leading up to Krista's death, apparently Krista went and changed her will to state that if anything was going to happen to her, Tony wouldn't get Ava. Her friend named Myra would get the sole custody of Ava, which is interesting.
The fact that it was him at one time and then recently she's changed it right before she died, I think.
Right.
Something happened.
Yeah. To mention, after Krista's death, Tony would end up going into like a custody battle over Ava with Krista's friend, Myra. But I'll get into that later. Unfortunately, the police weren't really able to find out any more information or evidence against Tony or Susan. And so they're both kind of just tabled as suspects for now, have no info on them. So we're going to just move on to the next person, basically. The next person they come into play is a guy named Thomas Churchwell. This one's super fucking weird. So Thomas lived down the street from Krista, and his full-time job, he was a musician. His full-time job, he was a magician.
Okay. This town is a little weird.
Yeah. Like, Thomas the magician, full-time. That's what he does.
Does anyone have real jobs in this town? The fish constable or magicians?
So at some point, police went to Thomas's house and they questioned him about Krista's death. They ended up asking him literally, quote, had he killed her because he was a magician?
Like he did it with magic?
Like, what the hell does that even mean? Like, Thomas is sitting there like...
Yeah, he did it with magic, or is he suggesting that all magicians are actually...
Murderers.
Yeah,
well, Thomas is sitting there like, what the hell is going on? Why does my magician-ness have to do with committing a murder? I mean, it didn't really make any sense. It didn't pan out. Nothing happened from it. The police were just pulling on strings on that part. So Thomas was obviously checked off the suspect list and continued on with his magician-ness. Next suspect. It actually ended up being Krista's father and his girlfriend. So Krista's father, you know, prominent dude back in Boston. He's like 72 at this time. His girlfriend was 29 and she was an ex-heroin addict and an ex-prostitute. Obviously, the police were thinking, like, maybe the girlfriend killed Krista, like, because if it was, her name was Elizabeth, by the way. So, like, if Elizabeth killed Krista, then Elizabeth would be in line for getting all of the dad's money. Like, I guess that's what was set up in the will. So, and Krista, in her diary entries at some point, did talk about how, like, she knew Elizabeth's past and that basically she was just there using her dad for money. Like, she was very aware. I mean, 72 and 29, can't help but think, you know. That being said, the police once again did not find anything. They weren't able to pin either of them down and they were ruled out. At this point, the cops are just trying to figure out what the hell's happening, don't really have any suspects, but it wasn't really like that they didn't have any suspects to go after. It was more so that there were too many possible suspects. Because if you can remember, crime scene wasn't locked up. So there were tons and tons of fingerprints and DNA everywhere from so many different people. Like, people just walking in the house, touching shit, you know? So it makes sense. But as for Krista and the DNA that was found on her body, of course, there was like Ava's fingerprints, Tim's. But then there was also saliva and sperm DNA that was found from an unknown source. Unfortunately, because of the way Krista was found, you know, basically naked, only had a shirt on, we just have to kind of assume that like a sexual act had occurred prior to her dying or as she died, you know, this unknown saliva and sperm DNA. This is basically the one thing that the investigators were able to focus on when trying to figure out Krista's killer. They're like, whoever this is definitely that did it. So the police department put out a $25,000 reward for anyone that could give information leading to an arrest in Krista's case. But not only did they put out a reward, but the subsection of Cape Cod, Truro, the police asked for all male residents to voluntarily submit DNA samples to them. Which nowadays, like, we've heard of cases that have done this. You know, they asked for the town to help out, submit DNA from males, females, certain type of people, blah, blah, blah. But this is like 2002. This is not a heard thing. People were like very freaked out about this. I think I read somewhere that at the time there was like 700 to 800 men in the Cape Cod community. So that's a lot. That's a lot of people. But also, like, what if you decline? Then they're going to be like, you don't want to help. Are you guilty? Blah, blah, blah. But it's also an invasion of privacy. So I don't like, but if you're not guilty, why wouldn't you do it? You know, it's just, it's a weird, I don't know. Would you guys voluntarily submit your DNA?
I already did.
Well, I guess I did too.
Yeah. I mean, I have, okay. But in this situation, we all have, but in this situation, would you have done it?
Yes, because I don't plan on committing crimes.
You never know, Kylie. You never know.
You know, you never know. I mean, I don't know if this is what they did, but I feel like in these situations when you're DNA testing like all men in the town, I feel like you should destroy the DNA after you confirm it's not a match.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know they ain't going to do that. It's police. They're going to keep that shit in their system.
I know they are, but I feel like they shouldn't.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, that all being said, it worked because 3 years after Krista's murder, the Cape Cod police received a DNA match. On April 15th, 2005, police linked the DNA found on Krista's body, both the saliva and sperm, to a man named Christopher McCohen. So Christopher, he was the local garbage man. Apparently, while Christopher was working, you know, doing his little garbage route and whatnot, he would stop at different houses and pick up their garbage, but also go inside and like have sex with the woman voluntarily, you know, like not rape, but like he had multiple relationships. They would have sex. He'd peace out, go back on his garbage route, you know, fantastic job for him. But according to Christopher, when he was being interrogated at the police station, he said that Krista was like one of these women. He would stop at her house and whatnot. But we don't know the relationship, like the extent of the relationship, Krista and Christopher. Like, was it just hookups? Were they ever dating? We don't really know. All we know at this point is that he did confirm they had hooked up at least once in the past. I don't know why this happened, but at some point it was made public that Christopher was the match to the DNA on Krista. People were a little pissed off about that to the local police. They were like mad that the police had taken so long to find Christopher. He was a local man in Cape Cod. He picked up Krista's trash every week. It was like the police had basically interviewed every other male in the town except for Christopher.
With everything going on in Krista's life, I think the trash man would be at like the bottom of the list. So I kind of
just wouldn't think. Let's talk about Christopher. Christopher McCohen. He's a 33-year-old local man to Cape Cod. He has 3 kids of his own from 3 different baby mamas. He's just like doing his own thing. I also do want to say that Christopher was African-American, which is a huge minority in Cape Cod. When the crime happened in 2002, there was less than 1% of Black people living in Cape Cod.
Associate that place with being like just white.
Yes, that I do too. Like when I think Cape Cod, I just think rich white people.
Yeah.
He was a really quiet guy. He lived by himself. He was really only known to people in Cape Cod to be the local garbage man, which very sad. But people did advocate for him. They said he was really chill, super sweet, not violent, and he would do anything for everyone. A lot of people like came to his defense once his name got out there. But what people didn't know is that Christopher had a criminal record. He had a background. He had been arrested quite a few times for domestic violence, and he had a few restraining orders as well. So that ain't helping you, Christopher. That ain't helping you. People were like, Christopher could have never killed Krista, but like they didn't know his background. So could he? yeah, maybe he had some violence and some stalking issues, but people were actually more assuming that he was just being racially profiled in the town. Like, that was the first thing that people thought. And not to mention, when the DNA was tested and they found out it was Christopher and it was a match and everything, they also found out that the saliva and sperm were days old. So it wasn't fresh on Krista or in Krista when they found her, which I think plays a big part, because you were thinking, like, if you're thinking Krista got raped when she was killed, this wouldn't have been from him, because it was multiple days old,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless they didn't ejaculate when they raped her. You know, it's just a weird, I don't know. I just want to point that out, because personally, I threw that into the story because I saw it only on one article and they had like background for it. But I feel like that's a really big thing.
It could be there from, you know, consensual relations.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
So regardless of the situation, Christopher was arrested. He was charged with Krista's murder, and he ended up facing the charges of first degree murder, aggravated rape, and also aggravated armed burglary. The trial for Christopher began in 2006 in October in Cape Cod. And this trial, honestly, like, it gained lots of media attention. It was made public. Lots of people went. But the trial itself was, like, heavily questioned, especially on the prosecutor's end and how the police investigated and conducted their investigation against Christopher. And you'll totally understand why. Apparently, when the police originally arrested Christopher and brought him in for questioning, he was hella intoxicated. Like, the dude was blacked out drunk. He couldn't even stand up on his own. They had to help him walk. And yet, the police still interviewed him. I don't know. Like, I ain't gonna lie. I don't know the law on this. But I have to assume, if someone is so intoxicated or high or not in their right mind, you cannot question them and interrogate them right then and there.
I mean, I guess you could, but I feel like even a low-level defense attorney could get that thrown out.
Right. So the police interviewed him and questioned him that exact same night, and that's where they gained all of their evidence from. So apparently when they first talked to Christopher, he had told them, like, he knew Krista, but not that well. And then later on the night, he told them about his little, like, fun outings during his garbage routes. But by the end, they told him about the DNA and how it was a match to him. And he said, apparently, quote unquote, it could have been me, end quote. Prosecutors took this and ran with it. So did the police. I mean, that's a pretty good sentence to have on it. But just remember, this is all happening while he's blacked out drunk, belligerently drunk. So don't even know if that's legal. One of the things that the defense would later say on is that the police also used the tactic of forcing a confession out of someone, which we hear quite often in some cases. In general, when police force a confession out of someone, like, has the suspect been there for hours or days? You know, are they in a clear mind? It basically is just making someone believe that they did it, or putting words into their mouth so that they can now say, like, this is it. This is who did it. Let's get a trial going, book them, put them in jail, kind of thing. And that was definitely the case for Christopher. Like, he didn't remember a single thing about his questionings because of how drunk he was. During the trial, prosecution read aloud part of Christopher's interrogation script from his interviews when the police had arrested him. And at some point, it said that Christopher had admitted that Krista had asked him to come to her house one day, which happened to be the same day she was killed, to help her get rid of her Christmas tree. She asked him to come over, help me get rid of the Christmas tree, like, put it in your dump truck. And then one thing led to another and they had sex. Christopher saying this, apparently. They stated that Christopher also told police that the night Krista was killed, he had been driven to her house by one of his friends. One of his friends' names was Jeremy. Apparently, Christopher and Jeremy were drinking at a party. Christopher didn't want to drink and drive. So Jeremy was like, I'll drop you off at Krista's house so you can spend the night. But of course, in trial, Christopher's like, I didn't say any of this shit. Like, where's the script coming from? I don't remember saying any of this. And now get this. This is mind blowing to me. I didn't look it up to see if it was still going on today. I hope it isn't. But apparently in the state of Massachusetts, if you don't want your interviews to be recorded while you're being interrogated, you can opt out. So they don't have to be like video or audio recorded. Now, Christopher in this situation didn't want to be recorded when he was being interviewed blacked out drunk. And he told them that. So they didn't record. So there's no effing video or audio recording of anything that Christopher said the night that he got interrogated. There's no physical proof that he said anything. But yet police and investigators and prosecution are allowed to use their script that was written down from that night to prosecute him for crimes or anyone.
Taking notes and then writing it out later? Or is there like a little stenographer in there?
There's supposed to be a stenographer in there. But that being said, they're working for the police station and the police are like, this is our dude. They could write whatever the hell they wanted to for a script. Like that doesn't, I feel like if you give me someone's writings and be like, this is the proof he killed someone, but there's, and he told us this, there's no way in hell that that should be allowed in court.
No.
At all. They could just write their own story. I mean, there's so much room for errors purposefully or not. So anyway, so that was the situation and prosecution went off of that script. So that's the only thing that they had against Christopher other than the DNA that was days old. So this is what the police, the prosecution saying in trial that Christopher told them. Christopher said him and Jeremy were out at a party. Christopher wanted to go back to Krista's house for a nightcap. He didn't want to drive there because he was drunk. So Jeremy drove them. Christopher said that once they get there, Krista lets them inside. Her and Christopher go upstairs to rendezvous. While all of that is going on, apparently Jeremy was downstairs in the house and he was like ransacking the house. He was stealing stuff, you know, throwing shit around. And once Krista and Christopher are done, they come downstairs. Christopher and Jeremy are heading out. And that's when Krista saw that like some of her stuff had been stolen. So she runs outside after them, confronts Jeremy about stealing shit. And apparently Jeremy snapped and started beating the shit out of her. And then at some point, Christopher joined in and they dragged her back into her house. Jeremy grabbed a kitchen knife and began stabbing her. But remember, prosecution is saying this, saying that Christopher told the police that the night that he was interrogated. It goes without saying in the whole trial, Christopher is saying, hell no. Even if that did happen, why would I have told you guys that? Like, in no way, shape, or form did he say that happened. That was not the truth. He never said that. And basically the police were lying.
So I don't know what to believe.
Basically, the trial is just like a back and forth of like who said what. None of the stories matched up other than the physical saliva and semen that was found on Krista's body. There's nothing else that tied Christopher to this murder. Like no, there was no evidence, no murder weapon, no fingerprint DNA evidence. Like police were just going off of this apparent story that Christopher had told them. And remember how I said earlier that Krista had defensive wounds? Mm-hmm. So apparently investigators found 4 sets of DNA under Krista's fingernails. None of them were Christopher. Not a single one of them. I mean, this just screams there's a good chance, a very good chance he did not kill her. And not to mention the fingerprints found on her, none of them were his either. So like it was just the DNA from days before. And on top of that, get this, blue and white fibers were found on Krista's body and they were said to be of clothing fibers of some sort. Now, remember, Christopher and his friend are out at a party that night. There's literally a picture from that night at the party that is brought into court. In the picture, you can see Christopher has a black t-shirt on and black pants. In the picture from the party, Jeremy, his friend, is also in it. And what was he wearing? A blue and white sweater. Of course, Jeremy is brought to the trial on the defense side and he swears up and down he had nothing to do with Krista. His story was absolutely different than what the prosecution was saying. Jeremy said that after the party, the two of them parted ways. He never drove Christopher anywhere. Jeremy went back to his friend's house and stayed the night. Jeremy's saying he went back to his friend Sean's house. Sean even comes to the trial and says, yeah, that's what happened. Like Jeremy and Christopher never hung out after the party. Something else I do want to bring up that was said in court. Apparently, one of Krista's neighbors testified, not the magician, a few days before Krista's body was found. This man was walking around the neighborhood and he saw a Caucasian male driving a black car speeding out of Krista's driveway and like swerving to like not hit stuff on the road. And the neighbor says this because he's like, I vividly remember this because of how fast and crazy this car was driving, said that he knew something was, he was like, something's not right with this person in this car. But unfortunately, police never were able to put two and two together, never figured out whose person, like whose car this was or who the person was. Now, for the defense's turn, they pretty much said that Christopher never went to Krista's house that night. In fact, he had been there the day before helping her with the Christmas tree, which was true. That day that he was helping her with the Christmas tree was a Thursday, and that lines up with trash day in the community. So like Christopher had been working his route, stopped at Krista's house, helped her with the Christmas tree, and went back on his route. Like there's proof, timeline, dates and stuff that that's what happened. Unfortunately, none of this helped in court. Because on November 16th, 2006, after 8 days of deliberating, the jury found Christopher guilty of first-degree murder, guilty of aggravated rape, and guilty of aggravated armed burglary. And he was sentenced to life without parole. When the verdict came out, like shortly after, one of the jury members stepped forward. This jury member was a black female. Also, she was the only person of color on the whole jury. That's something to point out. And she said, from day one, all of her fellow jury members talked about how Christopher was guilty and they pretty much refused to believe anything else that was said in court. And it was because of her, they were deliberating for 8 days because she refused to change her verdict because she was like, there's no evidence that he's guilty in this. And they refused to change. And so at some point they ended up voting unanimously. So, but like that jury member came forward pretty quickly and was like, hey, this is really effed up what happened. So because of that, in 2008, a court hearing took place. And right before that court hearing, three other jury members came forward and said the exact same thing. They said that there was racism in the jury selection and that basically they had just decided to make him guilty regardless of the evidence. So that hearing took place to figure out whether racism was a factor in the jury's decision to convict Christopher. Somehow, in December 2010, 2 years later, the Massachusetts Supreme Court denied that appeal. So they denied having Christopher have a new trial. Obviously, I think it's bullshit, but I obviously am a heavy believer of like there had to have been a reason. If it went to the Supreme Judicial Court, like there has to be evidence or some reason that they didn't overturn. Well, I don't want to say I believe in the law, but sometimes I don't. Okay. So in 2017, you know, a few years ago, Christopher from prison did a phone interview with a woman named Sunny Hostin. I don't know if you guys know who Sunny is. She's a lawyer. She talks on the talk show, The View, but she's also a senior legal correspondent and analyst for ABC News. So like she knows her shit. And in this interview, Christopher gave his side of the story again about how he had met with Krista on Thursday, the day before her death. They hooked up. That would make sense with the timeline of this like sperm and DNA. But he didn't see her after that. He went home after the party. Like the police never said any of this. They obviously had their own script that they went by. So we don't know which one's right. But at some point, Christopher's legal team figured out that they believed there was new evidence that could lead them to a retrial. That was, because this is interesting, the new evidence that they found is Christopher's friend, Jeremy. He had a special relationship with the police that were in charge of Krista's murder. On the night that Krista was murdered, Jeremy and Christopher at this party, right? Jeremy received a phone call from the police at midnight while he was out partying. Like there's no voicemail. There's just the receipt that the police called Jeremy that night. Why? In what manner do the police ever call you? And also at midnight on the night that now a woman has just been killed.
Are you like an informant?
You're reading my mind, Kylie. So the theory I had is Jeremy is probably an informant. Because I also found out Jeremy had a criminal history. He had tons of drug charges. And Christopher was known to occasionally use drugs. So I think maybe Jeremy was an informant. he might have actually been the one that killed Krista that night, and the police are now covering their tracks to, like, keep him as an informant. I don't know. Just a thought.
Conspiracy time.
I don't know why Jeremy would have killed Krista to begin with, but we have no proof of anybody going to her house. We have no proof of what the guys did that night after the party, but we do have proof that the police called Jeremy at midnight that night, and we don't know why. Another theory of mine, and I feel like this one's kind of blatant, like everybody at some point has to have thought about this, that Tim killed Krista. Stalker ex-boyfriend Tim, who also found her body. It makes sense. He was the one that found her body. He just so happened to decide to go return this damn flashlight when her body is being found. And when he gets there, he's touching her. So his fingerprints are all over the place. You know, at least that's his story, is that I was checking her pulse, I was helping her, blah, 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 and all this stuff. So his fingerprints are DNA everywhere. His DNA is also all over the house, but he was an ex-boyfriend. So we don't know. I also want to know, did Tim drive a black car? Like, where did this black car situation come from? And why was it never, like, looked into, you know, that the neighbor saw? I'm just saying. I think it could have been Tim.
I feel like he had more motive to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because also think about this. Christopher, the garbage man. If Tim, you know, Tim was known to stalk Krista, show up at her house, look through the windows. Did Tim ever see the garbage man, Christopher, in Krista's house?
Mm.
And he's like, oh, hell no. You're not allowed to have relationships with anybody else. You're done.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm leaning towards Tim.
But I want to just throw this out there again. Those blue and white fibers found on Krista's body were clothing pieces. And the night of Krista's death, same night that the police called Jeremy, Jeremy was wearing a blue and white sweater.
That doesn't mean anything to me, because I'm like,
yeah,
how many blue and white fibers do I have, like, in my house, you know?
I don't know. I'm just throwing it on there. But of course, who do I feel most bad for in this situation and this whole entire thing? Ava. Poor little baby Ava. It makes me absolutely sick, breaks my heart that she was found with her mom's body. She was trying to help her and clean her up. I guess in a good way, because she was only 2 years old, it's something that she's not ever going to remember except for what she's being told and what she sees on the internet. Speaking of Ava, she is now in college. She lives a very normal life. She did end up living with her mom's friend full time. Her mom's friend, Myra, and baby daddy, Tony, ended up having a custody battle. And for one reason or another, Myra won over Tony. I tried to look it up, couldn't figure it out of, like, maybe what happened during their custody battle, but the friend won. So Ava grew up with her mom's friend. That being said, she quite often still saw Tony and Susan. Apparently she did end up growing up in Cape Cod. Everyone still lived there. So she had a relationship with them the whole time. So no beef, all good, all good in the hood. So that's a positive outcome from this story. As for Christopher, to this day, he is still in prison. All of his appeals have continued to be rejected. There's nothing going forward. His legal team says they're going to continue to push for an appeal, for a new trial, anything possible to have a mistrial again. And that is the story of the murder of Krista Worthington.
I have a lot of thoughts.
Tell me.
Like, the whole crime scene, the door being kicked in, stabbing, like, that's personal anger, like, outburst.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the kitchen knife, like, I don't know if you said it or not. Was the knife that she was stabbed with, was it her knife, like, in the house?
It was a kitchen knife. They never found the kitchen knife, and they never said whether or not there was a knife missing from her kitchen. But I have to imagine it was one of her kitchen knives.
I mean, one, what would Christopher's motive be to go and kill her?
Or Jeremy.
Yeah. Like, he didn't really even know her. But then the weird thing about Christopher, the drunk interrogation, even if you're blackout drunk, like, why would you make up that story?
Because I don't think it happened. I think the police literally wrote that script. There's no proof, video or audio, that Christopher said any of that shit. I think the police were like, we have his DNA as a match. This is our guy. We've been looking for years. We're also slightly racially profiling. Not slightly, maybe a lot. And they went after. I mean, if you're a bad cop in this situation and you're racist, and you want to get all the glory for finding a murderer in your small town, hell yeah, are you going to rewrite that script?
But here's my thing. Then why would they bring Jeremy into it? Especially if he's an informant. Like, I don't know right. why they would do that.
Yeah. I don't know either.
It's weird. I have no idea, honestly, on this one.
Frustrating. I'm leaning towards Tim, too, honestly. I just think that he had the most motive out of anybody, any of the suspects we brought up. And I don't know. I don't like the stalkerish aspect to him, the looking through your windows and all the weird Tim things.
That damn flashlight.
Yeah.
What the hell you got? Yeah. And then his dad, the first thing asking is, did you do it?
Yeah. If your parents are the ones questioning, like, you know, usually they're like, oh, not my kid, you know, but if they say that, I feel like it's a little odd.
That's all I got for you guys. You want to jump into overtime?
Yes. Most of the time, we think that, like, human trafficking is very far reserved from places in America, or at least I do, or, like, small towns. But over this past weekend, in the small town of Russellville, Arkansas, there happened to be two places, two locations called Angel Massage. And they actually have a total of 12 locations in Arkansas. I don't think they're all called Angel Massage. I think they're called like all different things, but they're run by the same people. Over this past weekend, the police executed a warrant on both of the locations, or I think three locations. Yeah, three locations, two of them being in Russellville, on Angel Massage Parlor. They had these people working that were all Chinese, and they were offered jobs in America, not knowing what they were. And so they all took the jobs, obviously. They came over, and just out of the three Angel Massages that were executed a warrant upon, there were 17 victims of human trafficking, and they range in ages from 29 to 65. They worked 13 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I can attest that that place is open until 9:30 because I drive by and all the windows are lit up. It says open. It's the only place in town still open in this very small town. So they said that they found a bunch of Chinese currency, a luxury vehicle, and about $70,000, and 17 victims that they are helping get assistance now. But also sad, but crazy. It's literally like probably 5 minutes from my house. So
yeah, that is crazy. I mean, what a small, first of all, tiny town. Something like this happened in Jupiter a few years ago, but it's always the damn massage parlors. Like, why? First of all, why do those exist? Have you ever heard of somebody going to one?
I have.
Have yes. you? Oh, no.
I have, unfortunately. But, like, normal people that just didn't. I don't know if they just, like, didn't know, or they were just naive to it. But, like, or, innocent people. Like, innocent people, bad. For real.
Okay.
Huh? Not me. Like, but, like. Being bad.
No, I have an idea. But maybe they were being bad people.
I don't think so. I actually think that they really just didn't know, like, girls that I know.
Yeah.
Have gone. So.
That's crazy.
Angel Massage. Angel if you see massage. It in your town.
So I wonder if they are going to, I mean, obviously they have to be looking into the other locations.
Yeah. I think that they have warrants maybe that they haven't executed yet. That's what the news articles that I've read sounded like, that they had already secured the search warrants and they just haven't done them yet. They arrested three people. So.
Human trafficking exists everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, people do not, I feel like that's also such a taboo topic that, like, people don't really understand. It is literally, it's everywhere. It's in every town. It's not in every town. But, I mean, the numbers for human trafficking that, like, the human trafficking organizations put out, that they're, like, this many people are currently being human trafficked and you would never know kind of things.
Yeah, it's like we all knew there was something sketchy going on with Angel Massage down the road, but especially when they opened their second location, I was like,
why?
Okay. Like, yeah. But I also just thought, okay, it could just be like a creepy massage parlor. We all know the ones I'm talking about. Like, maybe it's just a thing. Like, also not legal, but, you know, can be different than human trafficking. But, you know, that's what it was. So, anyways.
I think the biggest red flag is that there was two
in one town.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very small town. It's the only massage parlor in town. I mean, there's like actual spa, like hair salons that, you know,
Normal,
do
normal life.
legitimate massages, but yeah, a little creepy.
Yeah. Keep us updated on if we hear anything else about the other ones.
Other 12, yeah, I'll let you know.
Yeah. Damn, dude.
I'm a big hater and I hate
Yes.
a lot of things.
You're the biggest hater. I hate the way that you walk. I hate the way that you talk.
She'll talk. I see a lot of, fashion trends on TikTok and the trend of wearing like athleisure clothing, like maybe hoodie, leggings, yoga pants, sneakers, and then putting a blazer on top of that.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I feel like Holly might do this.
I feel like I've never done that, but I think I could get with it.
Yeah, I feel like this Holly would do this.
Yeah.
And Holly would look good doing it, but I still hate it.
Okay, that's fair.
You
Hate
might look
it.
good doing it, Holly, but we might make fun of you behind your back.
You know what I hate? Barrel jeans. I don't even know what the
Yes.
hell that is.
They're like,
Google
what
it real
is
quick. It's they're a new trend and they're very obnoxious and I can't stand them.
Absolutely not. Okay,
Yeah.
barrel jeans make it look like you're bow-legged.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like pickles from the back.
It does. It looks you're bow-legged. What the hell is that? Absolutely not.
No.
That is
Immediately,
not.
no.
And half of them are capris. Make it worse.
So bad.
Wait, Kate's not gonna know this. Google tabby shoes, TABI. Ollie, do you know about these?
I feel like I do.
They're very expensive.
What the hell is that? Oh,
This is
yes,
a
I, yeah. Oh,
what?
feet.
This is a, like, what were those Narnia books?
The
I'm
Lion,
sure.
the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, you're half,
The little centaur feet.
yep, he was half human, half centaur, and
What's
that's
the
his
point of
foot.
that?
I don't, all the fashion girlies and gays wear them because they're, expensive and cool and hard to get. They are the ugliest fucking thing I've ever seen in my
Where
entire
does
life.
it split your foot?
Between the
Like your
toes.
toes have to be split in some type of manner.
Yeah, and what if you have a big, I have a big toe, you know?
This is
One of
that
them.
is horrific.
I'm
That
sorry
is
for
ruining
ruining
your day, but
I just like I can't get
your day.
them out of my mind. I hate them so much.
I've heard skinny jeans are coming back.
I
I
saw
never got rid of them. I
And I
did. I hate myself.
oh, I may
I
never get
can't
rid
pull
of them.
off any other jeans
because when you are, it just depends on your body type. I can't pull off any other type of jean.
Yeah.
I tried the mom jeans. It made me look much bigger than I am. Skinny jeans were my only lifesaver. I mean, but I've switched to leggings for most part. Well, that's just postpartum. But now I'm getting back into jeans.
Yeah, I mean, I actually enjoyed the baggier jeans or like the straight cut jeans just because they're just like they feel more comfortable. So I actually like them. So when it happened, I was like, oh, heck yeah, I'm gonna get rid of all my skinny jeans. And now they're all gone. And Alex Earle posted herself in some new skinny jeans the other day and said they're back. So
The
damn it,
fact
I
that
guess they're
that's
back.
your fashion guru to go to.
No, it's not. It's the kid. Well, yeah, I do like her, but I think the young people
Not.
like her, and the young people set the trends. We're no longer the young people.
No, we aren't. We're old.
If Alex Earl
Old
says
and
skinny jeans
devout.
are back, they're back. That's the rule.
And also, I'm always searching for like, what's the shoe of the season gonna be? And then it's all always sold out. And it's like these kids, they get it so fast. I don't know how to live anymore.
Those freaking Birkenstock clogs are probably still sold out.
Oh, I know. I asked, this is so like cringy of me, but I asked for some for Christmas from my mom and they were all sold out. So she just had to get me a gift card to get them. And I still haven't gotten them yet because they're all sold out. Because
Birkenstock.
these kids,
Yeah,
these
these
darn
children.
kids.
And with that, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. For more information about the case or just information about us, you can visit us on our website at overmydeadpod.com. Check us out on all of our social medias. We're everywhere, you guys. Like, subscribe, give us reviews, hit us back with comments. We love to interact. And we'll see you guys next week for another episode. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.